sub one of 740, and sub two says no disciplinary action shall be taken against any employee for the disclosure of any alleged activity described in subsection one of this section under investigation or for any related activity. That seems to key it to a reported activity that's under investigation. And I'd ask, whose investigation is that, and what about an occasion where there's not an investigation underway? It seems to strip the protection away from a person who reports something that is not under investigation.
Mr. Chairman, the end of that particular subsection says under investigation or for any related activity. Is your question, does that mean that the item disclosed needs to be under investigation in order for this to kick in?
I'm trying to determine the extent of the protection that you're saying 740 provides. It appears to me that it provides some protection when something is under investigation. And I'm not sure what or for any related activity means. And that's the other, under investigation or for any related activity. So maybe this will take some additional thought to try to figure out what the effect of the current statute is. And it would be beneficial to me if we could have an indication of how many people have utilized the procedure that is provided in 740 and also in 240.316 sub 5, which you also indicated, mm-hmm. It solves the problem. Has that been utilized, and when has that been utilized? It's my understanding that there's no adequate protections in current state law, that the utility provided by the existing statutes isn't adequate to what we need. So, if you can give us the number of cases that have gone through these procedures for which you've adopted rules, and how those cases have been resolved, would be helpful.
Senator, I'll try to get that information for you as soon as possible. In addressing other sections of this bill, in particular Section 5, dealing with information, disclosing information regarding convicted felons, I would not like to comment on the case in Springfield brought up earlier. That case is under litigation, and it would be improper for me to comment on that. In general, as far as disclosing information regarding convicted felons, I'd like to bring to your attention
people under warrant for arrest.
under
warrant, right?
Felony warrant for arrest.
Right. I'd like to bring to your attention, if I may, another bill which is before the Legislative Assembly. House Bill 2298, A. Engrossed, which passed the full House last week and has been referred to this committee, addresses specifically the issues which have been debated earlier here. Mm-hmm. And the Executive Department believes that this bill contains a better solution than the provisions provided in Senate Bill 1051. We would recommend to the committee to take a close look at that bill in comparison and make a decision based on that comparison.
What is that bill number?
2298 A. Engrossed was referred to Senate Labor on 3-9.
That's the Employment Division bill.
Right.
It would allow rulemaking authority of the Employment Division to adopt rules to disclose certain otherwise confidential information. It wouldn't require a notice of a person subject to a felony warrant for arrest. And there's some other concerns, too. The primary concern is that currently, under current law, the Employment Division, in this case, could have said yes and did. So there was no obstruction to the ability of the head office, the Employment Division, to say, yes, help catch the crook. They made a choice not to. And that's the real problem that we have. The should we allow agencies to refuse to release this information? And that's one thing that Senate House Bill 2298 doesn't address. It doesn't require disclosure.
Senator Hill, I do have a copy of the bill. I could read the relevant provision into the record if you like, or the committee could review that bill on their own.
I expect the chairman will bring the bill forward.
I guess to sum up my comments, we feel that the provisions in current law based in ORS 240 provide adequate protections to state employees in reporting mismanagement, waste of funds, and the other provisions of the statute, and that the in terms of reporting people wanted on felony warrants, that is better handled through another bill that will be coming before this committee shortly. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, not at this time. Yeah, thanks for waiting.
Sure.
We have Betty Reynolds. Betty still here? I have Janine Rodriguez, Dennis Phillips, Larry Ann Ellis, Tom Johnson, and Amy Clare still on the list. I think some folks have left. Others are here. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, my name is Betty Reynolds. I'm director of the Ethics Commission. On Friday, I received a request from you to provide comments on Senate Bill 1051. The full commission hasn't had an opportunity to review the bill, but I did discuss it in general terms with the commission chair and vice chair. In a nutshell, the laws administered by the Ethics Commission prohibit use of office to obtain financial gain, and Senate Bill 1051 presents no technical problems with as it relates to Chapter 244 or government ethics laws administered by the commission. The commission supports in concept whistleblowing protections. As you know, current statutes provide such protections only to state employees, and it seems that Senate Bill 1051 improves those statutes by providing more specificity through definitions, specifying procedures, and particularly extending those protections to local government employees. I don't mean to be having two executive branch agencies sending conflicting signals, but the Ethics Commission, in conceptually at least, does support the concept of whistleblowing protections. And as I said, it does not seem to present technical problems with the laws administered by the commission.
Question? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Janine Rodriguez? And Larry Ann Ellis.
Lorraine.
Did I mispronounce that?
Lorraine.
Lorraine, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janine Meyer Rodriguez, and I'm the political director of the Oregon Public Employees Union. I don't have testimony today. I have three OPEU members with me who came here with the courage enough to come before you to testify on some issues relating to incidents in their own workplaces. However, I would like to comment on one section in the bill, Section 5, Sub 2. I believe that if we limit the notification by an employee to their supervisor, that may avoid some of the confusion that we've been discussing. I do think that it's important to keep the language shall promptly, at least express the urgency to report problems in the workplace, but I think it should be limited to the employee's immediate supervisor. That way it's up to the employer to respond in the case of a felony situation, because I think it's unclear how an employee might know whether there is a warrant out for their arrest. So I think if we limit it, that might avoid some of the confusion and the different interpretations that employees and agencies might have on that.
Janine, you'd recommend that we have language that just says notify the employee's immediate supervisor, and then some additional language that requires the supervisor?
Yeah, I would add
notify, or the employer to notify state police.
Senator Hill, I would add if you just limit it under Section 2 to say that the employee will notify the employee's immediate supervisor, and then you could say and the employer shall notify the Oregon State Police.
Okay. And they would have some channel or policy to do that promptly and without delay. But the responsibility to notify and state police would then rest with the employee.
Yes. With that, if there are any questions about that, I'll just give it to Lorraine.
Okay.
My name is Lorraine Ellis. I'm the union steward in the East Multnomah Employment Office with the State Employment Division. And as the steward, I'm the person that everyone comes to with their concerns in the office. There was one case last September. Employment Division seems to quibble over confidentiality more than most agencies, I think. And last September, a memo was put out by one of the supervisors in my office that said that it was policy that not more than one person should be allowed to be present at a job referral interview. And the memo went on to say, and this was underlined, that that meant we were not allowed to have translators present at job referral interviews. When I saw that memo, it appeared to me to be clearly discriminatory and I thought probably illegal, because it meant that we would be refusing service to people who didn't speak English, to hearing impaired people, that we would simply refuse to provide them with job referral assistance. And I thought that was, you know, discriminatory, a violation of equal protection laws and civil rights laws. I told that to my supervisor and he agreed with me. He hadn't seen the memo before that. He went into the manager's office and they called the person in Salem who a previous memo from the executive staff had identified to us as the person to call with confidentiality questions. About an hour later, my supervisor came back and said, that's policy from Salem, there's nothing we can do about it. I said, well, if that's official agency policy, there's no reason why I shouldn't make sure that legal aid and some other appropriate people know about it, is there? And he said, no, no reason. The next evening, I was at an event attended by several members of the legislature and some other people. And I shared this memo with three members of the legislature and a member of the governor's staff. The following workday, the governor's office called the administrator's office of the employment division, and the policy was rescinded. But word came down that I had called the governor. I was called into my manager's office and questioned about my activity. She said, you didn't really call the governor, did you? And I said, no, I ran into a friend of his at a party. The policy was rescinded, as I said. I was called into the office again the following week and told that in the future, if I think policy is incorrect, I should tell my manager. If I don't like what she says, I should tell the regional manager. If I don't like what he says, I should tell the assistant administrator for field operations. And if I don't like what she says, I should tell the administrator of the employment division, but that I should not talk to anyone outside the agency about policy. I told her that anytime she directs the people I represent to do something that I feel is illegal, I will pursue whatever avenues I think necessary to protect them. She shuffled some papers and looked uncomfortable and said, of course. Approximately 2 months after that, we had all staff conferences at the Jansen Beach Red Lion. And in the opening address, Mr. Hunter, our administrator, told us that the people within the agency who had spoken to members of the legislature about the conference had hurt us all more than they knew. Later in the day, he said, we encourage open and responsible communication. Expressing disagreement with the policies of the executive staff is communication, but it's not responsible. These conferences were held in three sessions, and people who attended the third session told me that he had ranted at some length about the viper in our midst, who had spoken with the legislature. I don't think it was the intention of my agency to decide not to serve people who don't speak English. I think it was an accident, but that memo would have had that effect. I initially tried to go through channels by taking it to my supervisor, and that didn't get anywhere. The policy was rescinded very quickly when I spoke to someone who had the will to make sure that it was rescinded. And I think that it's important that state employees feel that they're free to do that kind of thing and not be so intimidated that they follow any directive that comes out, no matter how harmful they think it might be. That's what I had said.
When you were told not to go outside the agency, was there any implied threat?
No.
There was nothing explicit or implied that you, it was a directive, but they didn't say or else.
No, they just said, do not talk to anyone outside the agency about policy. Sometime after that, I had a meeting with the regional manager, and after we had concluded what he called me there, I said, oh, by the way, what's this garbage that if you can't violate the 14th Amendment, you want to violate the First? And he asked what I was talking about, and I told him, and he said, oh, that. Well, yeah, I guess you're right. We can't tell you not to talk to anybody you want to talk to. It's just we'd rather you didn't.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have Dennis Phillips. Let's see, and Tom Johnson, you're here together, right? Why don't you come up together? And Amy, you're the last one on the list. Do you want to come up and follow these gentlemen? Okay, why don't you come up and we'll take these gentlemen first and then your statement. Well, we'll need your names for the record so we can tell who's who.
Senator Hill, committee. My name is Dennis Phillips, and I'm a carpenter at the University of Oregon Physical Plant.
Senator Hill and the committee, my name is Tom Johnson, and I'm a carpenter at the Physical Plant at the University of Oregon.
Senator Hill and Senator Shoemaker and committee, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the Acting Research and Education Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO.
Okay, why don't you guys lead off and talk about your situation, which I think is going to be different from Amy's testimony.
Okay, I guess to start off first, right now at the physical plant at the University of Oregon, there's a internal investigation going on about the administration, from the top on down. We're not really here to discuss that today, but what we are here for is to testify in favor of the Senate Bill 1051. But the reason we did bring that up is the fact that three people who collected the information on this investigation or the allegations waited a number of years to bring it forward because they were afraid of retribution towards them. They were afraid of their job security. And it has been a typical practice of you play by the rules of the lead person or you do not advance. Mm-hmm. You get shuffled off in a different direction and sometimes disappear. So basically what we're here for today is just to give you a few examples of what happens when you bring things to the attention of your supervisors. And it comes in many, many forms. You can say refuse to work in a situation which you feel is dangerous. Your supervisor may say, that's fine, then I'll get someone else to do it. No real harm to you, but can show up on your performance appraisal every year, can put you on the list of people who get jobs that are kind of undesirable. It can also come in the form of a direct threat to your job. In one instance at the university, we had an employee who was directed by his immediate supervisor and the physical plant director at that time to break up plumbing fixtures that were removed during a renovation project. Quite a large sum of them, as a matter of fact. All seemed to be in reasonably good condition. So he questioned this to the president of the university and asked him, why were we breaking these things up instead of reusing them? Well, later he was confronted by his immediate supervisor and the physical plant director and said, they told him, you either keep your mouth shut or you're going down the road. So that was just a threat. There was also an instance, this unfortunately I was not at the University of Oregon, but happened to a gentleman who was an employee at the University of Oregon who transferred to another state institution. He was a paint supervisor at this institution and left Friday knowing what was in the storeroom in its place, came back Monday, noticed yellow striping paint missing, and that the striping machine, which is a spraying machine used to put lines in a parking lot, had been used over the weekend. upon further investigation, he noticed that the Elks Lodge in town had new striping in their parking lot. So, putting two and two together and knowing that one of the other supervisors is a member of the Elks Lodge, he contacted the director of this particular institution and informed him of the disappearing paint and the use of the striping machine, which the director obviously in turn talked to the gentleman who was charged with this theft, who then went to the Elks Club, got receipts from another member of the Elks Club showing that the material had been bought by him and his sprayer used. The original supervisor who turned this gentleman in was fired from his job.
Immediately after this?
Immediately after this.
Did he appeal the firing, to your knowledge?
I don't know. I don't think he has appealed it at this time. But basically, what we want as members of the employees of the state of Oregon is just a little bit of protection so that we can go to someone and report wrongdoings. I'm sorry the gentleman from the executive department's not here, because he suggested that we go to our immediate supervisor. In our case, we can't really do that, because there's nobody in where we work that we can really go to and tell these things without having retribution done to us. It should be an honor and a privilege to be here today testifying before this committee. But frankly, both Tom and I both feel quite intimidated to be here, and was afraid to even tell our immediate supervisor where we were going today, although he'll know now. It's hard to say what we're going to greet, you know, what we're going to meet tomorrow when we get to work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a shame.
The audit that's underway is looking at the allegations in that memo.
Yes.
That was sent. And the memo was anonymous, and specifically in that memo it stated it was anonymous because people feared intimidation and retaliation.
Exactly.
And you agree that that's why it was anonymous?
Oh, I know that's the reason. That's why the people appeared on a local station there in Eugene in silhouette with their voices altered. Mm-hmm.
And the allegations in that memo include theft of public property, alteration of there was contracting that was going on, and the contract process was not up and up. The decision about where the work was done was not on the up and up. And there were many other allegations too, which are being investigated.
Yes,
that's our understanding.
Do you want to come in?
Yeah, I just had a few examples.
Well, we're going to have to separate the male voices on the tape, so we'll need names each time a different person speaks.
Tom Johnson. I just had a few examples that some workers wanted me to bring up here today and present to you as problems that they run into, and it is directly related to reporting to your immediate supervisor, even above them. There was a warehouse worker, when he was interviewed for his job and asked by the person interviewing him if he would report a fellow worker for a theft or a violation of rules, and he said yes, he would. And then they asked him if he would report a supervisor, and he said yes, he would. So he was hired. Later he reported irregularities to the administration, but as he pursued it, the higher he got, at one point he was told that if he pursued it any further, he would be the one that would be in trouble, rather than the person that had done the illegal business. Electrical worker has been forced into a legal battle to get responsible installations of fire alarms and getting licensed people to do work that needs to be licensed, alarm systems and such. He was even approached by a management person and asked, what if we're doing it illegally, you do your job, let us do ours. A carpenter encountered asbestos in a room on campus, and the door was to be, a door with asbestos in it was to be cut with a skill saw. And the person working with him was concerned that if they cut into the asbestos, it would contaminate the room in the hallway. The worker was not trained at that time specifically in asbestos and the dangers of it. So the other carpenter cut through the door and hit asbestos and did contaminate the room in the hallway where people were moving up and down. Because he was concerned and knew there was somewhat of a danger, but not exactly what it was, he went to his supervisor when the job was completed and asked the supervisor, "Who do I tell in a case like this? This is clearly a hazard." And the foreman's response was, "You don't tell anyone."
When was that, for instance?
That was probably in maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
When asbestos was just becoming known as a problem.
Uh-huh. Also, there was a carpenter who had been told to keep a job below a certain point at the estimating stage. And what actually happened is the job was contracted out for a sum that was maybe it was actually nearly 10 times the cost that the price was supposed to be held at the estimating stage if we were to do it in-house. Yet when the job was needed in short time, they contracted the job out for nearly 10 times the cost. That's about all the examples I have. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions? Amy?
Okay. Chairman Hill and members of the committee, I stated before, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the Acting Research and Education Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO. I am here on behalf of the 280 unions, councils, and other labor organizations representing nearly 80,000 working men and women in this state to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1051. The State Labor Federation followed with great interest the convoluted case of a 12-year veteran of the State Employment Division being fired for reporting a wanted felon to the State Corrections Division. The Oregon AFL-CIO is appalled that a policy exists preventing state workers from notifying police authorities when a known felon is in their midst. As we understand the intent of this measure, Senate Bill 1051 will address ambiguities in the current statutes pertaining to confidentiality requirements to allow state workers to cooperate fully with law enforcement officials when quick action is needed to keep a felon from fleeing. We also understand this Whistleblower Act will provide protection for public employees who reveal violations of state or federal law, mismanagement, abuse of authority, or gross waste of funds on the part of state agencies. We recognize the need for confidentiality in matters concerning clients of state agencies, but no state employee should lose his or her job for reporting criminal activity and locating wanted persons. The Oregon AFL-CIO applauds Senator Hill for introducing this essential legislation, and we urge your support of Senate Bill 1051.
Okay, any questions of the witnesses?
I've been just sort of pondering all this, and I certainly see the value in such a bill, and how it would correct the kind of abuses that both of you have referred to and other witnesses have referred to. I also see that it can be used for mischievous purposes as well, to disrupt an organization, to report on what someone perceives as mismanagement, which upon cooler analysis would not be seen as such, but which could be very disruptive to the chain of command. And so I see that the thing could be abused, either intentionally or innocently, and I'm troubled how to fashion it so that it is, we can cure the abuses which are out there and at the same time not open up to new abuses. I'm wondering, and I might ask these witnesses how they would respond to this, if there were some kind of an ombudsman possibly already in place who could be the line of communication for this sort of thing, so that that ombudsman, who isn't the legislature or the governor or somebody, mm-hmm. who could come down hard, the ombudsman then could receive the information and try to find out if it's really a problem, if there's really an abuse, could kind of check with the agency and see whether, you know, how this thing sits, and sort of sift out the times when the whistle probably shouldn't have been blown, but see to it that the whistle is heard when it should have been. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how you would respond if we could come up with something that does that, how you'd respond to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Shoemaker, I'd have to get back to my organization on the idea of the ombudsman. However, the amendments that were proposed by Senator Cairns, I thought, might address some of that, because these people could be reprimanded or be legally held accountable if they were flagrantly trying to abuse their positions to report.
Senator Huff?
The problem with the private right of action, you've got to show damage before there's any kind of... And that's kind of a... In other words, you can go it, but the defense against the private right of action, how were you damaged?
Okay.
And you know what that damage would be, or would it be dollars and cents or reputation or whatever. It's an awful hard thing to prove.
Yeah.
You can prove it. You can prove that they said that. Proving the damage is a difficult thing to do.
Yes.
Dennis Phillips.
Yeah.